From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, political humorist Bill Maher returns to talk about some of the things he's been thinking and doing over the past few months while his HBO series was on its break. The new season of Real Time with Bill Maher starts next week. Also, we talk with writer Marilyn Robinson. Her new novel, Gilead, is told in the form of a letter from a Congregationalist preacher in his 70s to his 7-year-old son. It's a first novel since the publication of Housekeeping 24 years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new season of Real Time with Bill Maher begins Friday, February 18th on HBO. We invited Bill Maher to join us again and talk about some of the things he's been thinking about over the past few months in between seasons. Maher is one of the most outspoken and controversial political humorists working today. On each edition of his show, he opens with a satirical sketch, interviews politicians and activists from all sides, and moderates a roundtable of very opinionated people from the worlds of politics and entertainment. He doesn't pull his punches, and neither do his guests, even when they're taking aim at him. His final show of the previous season was right after the election. Maher interviewed Alan Simpson, former Republican senator from Wyoming. Maher congratulated Simpson for being on the winning team and asked what the blue staters, such as himself, don't get about the red states. Simpson started by explaining that he's pro-choice and opposes a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage.
The constitutional amendment I thought was inappropriate. I work diligently with the Republican Unity Coalition, which is a group of gay, straight Republicans who are very active. I've always been involved in that. Well, yeah, but that's making fun of people. I'll tell you where you missed the point.
I'm just trying to get invited to a party.
I know. You're making fun of Americans who have some religious bent or a faith. Mm. Keep doing that, and your people will never win an election, because whether you and I like it or not, this is the only country on the face of the earth that was founded because of religious persecution and a belief in God. That's why they left Europe. So keep making fun of them. Keep making fun of the gays and the lesbians, pulling people in, tearing people up, thinking that Hollywood has all the brains in America, from people who are making millions of bucks on one movie and telling the rest of the people and making fun of them, and you'll never make it. Never make it.
To quote the president, I'm getting a mixed message from you, Senator. I mean, either I'm making fun of the religious people or I'm making fun of the gay people. I can't be doing both, can I?
Well, you just made a little crack. You know, it was funny, you know, party. You know, those are little cracks. Those are smart little cracks about the gay, lesbian people.
Senator, are you yourself gay? Because, I mean, I have not heard anybody be this sensitive about a gay joke since Harvey Fierstein.
Well, keep telling them. You keep telling them. I think they're offensive.
I will keep telling them.
You keep telling them.
All right.
Bill Maher, when that happened on the last episode of last season's Real Time with Bill Maher, what were you thinking when Alan Simpson was saying this to you? What was going through your mind? You looked really stunned and almost at a loss for words, which you never are.
Well, I hadn't heard that in a while, so it's almost new to me. No, I let him have his say. I don't think I was at a loss. I was just waiting for him. I was being polite. I was trying to hold my fire till he... First of all, what he was saying was so fascinating to me, because I don't understand this chip on the shoulder that the winning side had. I understand a sore loser. I don't understand a sore winner. So I don't know. All I could think of is he must have got up on the wrong side of the ranch that day, because I really, listening back to that, hadn't said anything that I understood would be provocative to somebody. And for, you know, for someone sitting in Wyoming to be lecturing us on making jokes about the gays, I mean, I can understand making jokes. Yes, he's right. I do make fun of religion, and I will continue to make fun of religion because I think it's destructive and a waste of our time and energy. But, I've been very supportive of the gay movement, and most of the people in states like Wyoming have not. That's where the problem for the gays is coming from, is people who believe in religion. Gay marriage would not be an issue, except the Bible says it's a no-no for homosexuality to even exist in this world. Because, you know, if you boil Jesus' message down, it was, I hate tolerance.
when something like this happens, it's like this little blowout with Alan Simpson, do you feel like your humor is misunderstood, or that you're not being clear enough, or, you know, what goes through your mind about your humor when this kind of thing happens?
Well, my humor is definitely misunderstood by a large part of the country who normally don't watch my shows. That's a given. You know, if it was understood by the majority, then I'd have the ratings of American Idol. But but then what I would be saying would be so watered down and pandering and stupid, I couldn't live with myself and I couldn't look at the face I was shaving.
One of the things Alan Simpson said to you was, keep making fun of people with a religious bent and you'll never win an election. A few minutes after that, you introduced Andrew Sullivan on your panel. And Andrew Sullivan is a conservative Republican who is also Catholic and gay. And he's written extensively about all of these things. And let me play a little bit of what Andrew Sullivan said to you.
Bill, congratulations to you. Because you did your bit to help George Bush win the election. And so did the entire Hollywood left, who galvanize people in the middle of the country who are tired of being patronized, condescended to, and demeaned. I mean, if you want...
Have you been hanging out with Senator Simpson?
No.
Well, I'm just, how I'm come just this election to... got all to be my fault?
No. Of course it's not.
Amazing to me.
You just did it. You just made an assertion that someone who believes in Jesus has no legitimacy political discussion.
You know, in a political discussion, yes.
No, they do in a political discussion as long as...
Okay.
And let me explain why. Because someone's religious faith can lead them to have moral ideas and moral purpose.
Or not.
And that, or not, yes. But to deny that part of the country a voice to say that they are illegitimate and then expect them to vote for you...
Illegitimate, they won.
But the reason they won partly was because people are tired of being demeaned. Don't demean people and expect them to vote for you.
But Okay, that was Andrew Sullivan on Bill Maher's show. Bill Maher, do you feel like it's your fault that the Democrats lost the election?
Yes, and I'm proud. No, it's a silly argument that they're making. There's a billboard that I understand is going up here in Hollywood. Some right-winger is taking out a billboard that pictures a lot of the liberals who worked for the election of Senator Kerry and is thanking them for electing President Bush. Again, that attitude of the sore winner. You know, it's not enough to win. You got to stick a finger in the other guy's eye and say, you see, you get it now. I've heard a lot of that on radio and television the last few months. You get it, liberals? You get it? No, it wasn't a problem that we didn't get it. We just don't agree. This nonsense about morals and values. Do you see? What I see is people who confuse morals and values with traditions and rituals. I have morals and values, and lots of people do who don't believe in religion, like me, or people who don't even believe in God, which I sort of do. But even if you don't, you can be moral and you can have values. This morals values crowd has got to get their definition straight. They got to relearn what morals and values are. They're things like kindness and fairness and generosity and compassion, the things their big champion Jesus Christ talked about. He never talked about homosexuality, not even once, but apparently that's number one on their agenda.
Well, now that you lost the election for the Democrats single-handedly,
yes.
do you think Kerry should run again, or do you think that...
Nope.
Uh-huh.
Well, unless he learns, I think he did not represent his party well. Neither did Al Gore the previous election. I think when historians look back at these two elections against George W. Bush, they'll see pretty much the same guy, which was a tragedy in a way. I think in both cases you had candidates who were very bright, who were very capable leaders, but I do understand the doubt in people's minds as to what kind of leaders they would have been because they didn't run effective campaigns. And by effective, what I mean is they did not challenge the president on key issues. Where was the environment in this election? Where was the drug war in this election? Where was the use of the word incompetent? John Kerry, talking about Iraq, never used the word incompetent. If I was the candidate, I would have built the whole case around that, because he certainly didn't build the case that he would have done anything very differently. And I noticed after the State of the Union speech, the Democrats still haven't learned that. Their big rebuttal was, we have to train Iraqi troops faster. Yeah, no kidding. That's what we're trying to do. That's what the Bush administration is all about. Of course they want to train Iraqi troops so we can get out of there. That's just common sense. So if you're not going to differentiate on how you would handle Iraq, then what you have to do is say that this administration, and there's plenty of evidence to support it, has just bungled the job as badly as you possibly could. And John Kerry didn't make that case.
So it sounds like you're pretty unimpressed with the whole Democratic Party right now and how they're handling things?
Very unimpressed, very disappointed. They just don't know how to fight this guy. And apparently they believe the nonsense that swing voters don't like it when you attack the president. Well, swing voters didn't seem to mind it when the president attacked a war hero and basically called him a coward and a war criminal. Apparently that wasn't too rough for the swing voters. But God forbid that you get in George Bush's face and mention the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. That didn't come up in the debates. You know that phrase they use, the issues that are important to me? Well, the issues that are important to me are things like the environment and how we went into Iraq. I wasn't even completely opposed to the war. I didn't think it was the right thing to do. But you know what? When George Bush presented, I went, you know what? It could work. I'm 60-40. That's what I kept saying. I'm 60-40. I'm 60 against it, but let's see. And now that they've had an election over there, it actually looks better. Looks like it could work. But I think the lesson there is that, yes, freedom is a very, very strong, powerful force. In fact, it's so strong and powerful, it might even work when you've screwed up the situation as badly as you possibly could, and it still could work.
My guest is Bill Maher. The new season of Real Time with Bill Maher begins next week on HBO. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is political humorist Bill Maher. His show Real Time with Bill Maher starts its new season next week on HBO. Let me change over to the Super Bowl here. Did you watch the Super Bowl or at least the halftime show?
Oh, I watched the halftime show. And when Paul McCartney started to sing the lyrics to Get Back, I mean, I've heard this song a million times in my life, beginning when I was 12 or 13 or something. And... only in this dumbass country would you pause when he came to the lyrics about sweet Loretta Martin thought she was a woman, but she was another man.
You know, that went something, right past something. Me, of course.
But she, and then she gets it while she can. And, you know, I've heard that a million times and it never, and I thought, oh my God, what's going to happen? He was just talking about a transvestite nymphomaniac. The whole world's going to go crazy. Of all the lyrics to think of Paul. But that's just where we are culturally.
Speaking of language, did it surprise you when Senator Alan Simpson used the full word for BS on your show?
No, you know, that's Alan Simpson. He always was a straight shooter. I was trying to give him that compliment before he went off on me. But he was always that kind of a guy. And what's wrong with that word? That's a perfectly necessary good word.
But it's a word that I'm not sure you could say on network TV. Broadcast TV as opposed to cable,
no,
which is where
no, that's one of the. No, that's one of the few that's still on that list. But that will change, too, over time. Not this year, not next year, but... as I've pointed out before, I was the first person on network TV to use the word sucks. Like, I think the context was the airport sucks in 1983 on The Tonight Show. And after the show, they all were like ashen face and they couldn't believe it. And nobody complained. The switchboard didn't light up. It didn't seem to matter. And 3 days later, Johnny used it. So that's how it happens, you know? I mean, when I started in TV, you couldn't say so many of the words that are extremely common all over broadcast television. And the words that are really dirty words, you know they're saying anyway these days, and they just bleep them out.
So do you know what your new season's going to be like? What the first show will be like?
I can't because I don't know what's going to happen in the world. But I certainly am anxious to talk about some of the things that have gone on since we've been off the air, which I guess our last show was November 5th of last year. So, you know, we have Social Security and we have the Michael Jackson trial and we have a different world in Iraq. You know, I think that's a tough one for a lot of liberals and Democrats, Iraq, because, you know, Bush finally won one. And a lot of what he's been saying about freedom and how powerful, well, that doesn't look like such sentimental mere rhetoric anymore. And you have to work from the facts. I always say that. I've said that so many times. You can't work backwards from I hate Bush to now how are we going to find the reason why this is bad? This isn't bad. This is good. I've said that also. It was Bush's war, but it's America's peace. I'm thrilled that the election went well in Iraq. And these ideas that Bush has been presenting in his inaugural and in his State of the Union message about freedom, they're not new ideas. They're not his ideas. And so we shouldn't react to them like, oh, Bush is for freedom, so we're against. No, remember, we're for freedom. He was basically redoing John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech. Now, when John F. Kennedy said, pay any price, bear any burden, he was speaking to a generation that had paid any price and would bear any burden, as he himself did in World War II. This president, when he says basically the same thing, I don't know about that. When he says to these countries, if you stand for liberty, we will stand with you. What is he talking about there? That sounds like he's doing what his father did in 91 when he incited the Kurds and the Shiites in the South to rise up and then didn't wind up helping them. This guy cannot write a check that he can't cover. Although, let's be honest, writing checks he can't cover is pretty much the story of his life.
Do you mind changing your opinion, like if you oppose the war in Iraq, but now you think, you know, but this election was a good thing? Do you mind having to publicly amend an opinion?
Not at all. I always say, you know, one reason I'm glad I'm not a politician is a politician isn't allowed to change his mind. Because if you change your mind, then you're flip-flopping.
Right.
Then you're not resolute. But events change, and you have to go with, facts have to come first. The fact is that election was a very positive thing. The fact is that it didn't even matter what they were voting for. It was a hands across Iraq. It was a demonstration by those people that they wanted a real country, that they didn't want the insurgents, they didn't want the violence, that they didn't they didn't like us there as an occupying army, but it wasn't like they were on the side of the insurgents. Like in Vietnam, the Viet Cong had a lot more sympathy among the population than these insurgents do. So that was a very positive statement that those people made, and I think it's going to be big because I think it lifted the morale. The people saw that they were all, they needed to see each other. They needed to see the other people down the block coming out of their homes too. Oh, wow, we're all going to do this together. This is how we think. This is the majority now. So the momentum and the morale is now on the side of the people who came out to vote, and the insurgents look like what they are, which is people who lost.
You know, getting back to your show, when the clip that we opened with Alan Simpson talking to you, one of the things that he said later in the interview is that, you know, he was talking to you long distance and with only a headpiece, and he'd hear the audience applauding or cheering, and he found it very distracting, and he was afraid, well, you know, you got an audience that's going to be against him. And I know you've tried to stop people from applauding or cheering. Why does that bother you? You fail. I mean, people are very demonstrative in the audience on your show. But why would you prefer that they didn't cheer a lot?
Because it's boring. First of all, two reasons. One, it's just boring for the home audience. When I'm watching television at home, there's way, way, way too much studio cheering, for my taste anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's just boring, and nothing's going on when people are cheering. Yes, it's very exciting to be in the studio. It's very exciting when you're at David Letterman's show, But for the people at home, it's not that exciting. We're in bed, okay? That's number one. Number two, and I'm glad you brought this up because this is a good place to mention this. I am adamant this year about getting conservative audiences. I am throwing down the gauntlet there because we've tried to do this before, because I think it's very unfair for our conservative guests to have to come on. They have a legitimate gripe. Now, we can't help it that we live in a very blue city, in a very blue state. So obviously the people who are going to come into the studio and want tickets are mostly liberals. But it's very unfair. I would not want to go into a studio, and I have on occasion, where it's a completely conservative audience, and everything I say, they're going to judge harshly and boo and look on askance and applaud and cheer everything that the other guy says. That's not right. So we have tried to get a conservative audience before, and they don't want to come. And this year, I'm going to make a thing out of it. If they don't want to come, then it's going to be on them. I'll do a show for nobody. I'll put it out there. You know what? We tried to get a conservative audience. Here's who showed up. So don't complain anymore.
You going to take out ads on the Heritage Foundation website?
Come on. The studio only contains 300 seats or something like that. You're telling me that there's not 300 conservatives in all of Southern California? Believe me, they exist. And if they don't want to come and cheer on the conservative guests we have on our show, then they're, again, just being sore winners.
Well, welcome back to Friday Nights.
Thank you. Glad you're going to be there.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure as always, Terry.
Bill Maher's HBO series, Real Time with Bill Maher, starts its new season Friday, February 18th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a talk about writing and religion with Marilyn Robinson. Her new novel, Gilead, is in the form of a letter from a Congregationalist preacher to his young son. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Marilyn Robinson's new novel, Gilead, is a meditation on religion, family, war, and finding meaning in life. Reviewing it in the Washington Post, Michael Derda wrote that the novel is so serenely beautiful and written in prose so gravely measured and thoughtful that one feels touched with grace just to read it. This is Robinson's first novel since the publication of her 1981 book, Housekeeping. Gilead is set in 1956 in the town of Gilead, Iowa. The story is told in the form of a letter written by a 76-year-old Congregationalist minister to his 7-year-old son. The minister believes he is near death and is passing on the story of his life. The story encompasses the lives of his father, a pacifist, and his grandfather, who fought with John Brown and the abolitionists and lost an eye in the Civil War. Marilyn Robinson lives in Iowa and teaches at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. She belongs to the Congregationalist Church and is a former deacon. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of the novel as the father explains to his son that he's dying.
I don't know how many times people have asked me what death is like, sometimes when they were only an hour or two from finding out for themselves. Even when I was a very young man, people as old as I am now would ask me, hold on to my hands and look into my eyes with their old milky eyes, as if they knew I knew when they were going to make me tell them. I used to say it was like going home. We have no home in this world, I used to say. And then I'd walk back up the road to this old place and make myself a pot of coffee and a fried egg sandwich and listen to the radio, when I got one, in the dark as often as not. Do you remember this house? I think you must, a little. I grew up in parsonages. I've lived in this one most of my life, and I've visited in a good many others, because my father's friends and most of our relatives also lived in parsonages. And when I thought about it in those days, which wasn't too often, I thought this was the worst of them all, the draftiest and the dreariest. Well, that was my state of mind at the time. It's a perfectly good old house, but I was all alone in it then, and that made it seem strange to me. I didn't feel very much at home in the world. That was a fact. Now I do.
That's Marilyn Robinson reading from her new novel, Gilead. Your novel, Gilead, is written in the form of a letter. It's this minister, John Ames, in his 70s, who believes he is dying, writing a letter to his 7-year-old son that he hopes his son will read much later in life. And, you know, a lot of people advise beginning writers, write as if you're writing a letter home or a letter to your best friend, and that will help capture your most direct and natural voice. Did writing this novel in the form of a letter from father to son help in any way?
Well, writing a novel is an odd thing. The situation occurred to me as something that simply I wanted to enter into. I have never myself particularly liked to read epistolary novels, and I guess that's basically what this one is. But the given of this of the novel for me from the beginning was that he would be in this situation where he's speaking very lovingly to an adult man whom he will never know, his grown son, and trying to, in effect, be a father to someone who's much too young to actually remember him as father at the time that he imagines he will die. I could almost say that I surprised myself. This isn't a kind of form that I would ever have imagined that I would choose to write in. I felt that I could do it because I knew the voice of the writer. I felt very strongly that I knew who this character was. So that it wasn't a problem, but it also wasn't a resource for me either.
The novel is written, I mean, he's writing this letter to his son in 1956, and he's in his 70s. So it's really, in a way, he's using the language of another era, and he's also a fairly, I shouldn't use the word formal exactly, but, I mean, he's not a frivolous man. by any means.
He's not.
So, you know, the language you use very much reflects that. Like, instead of calling somebody, you know, nervous or fidgety, you'll write, he was the most unreposeful human being I ever knew. Can you talk a little bit about the language that seemed to suit the voice of this minister in 1956?
Well, one of the things that was characteristic in that tradition is that they were very highly educated people. And one of the things that they did do was establish many of the colleges that are scattered through the Middle West, places like Oberlin and Grinnell and Knox College, Carleton College, and so on, very fine little institutions that they established in the first instance as good liberal arts colleges, which were also on the Underground Railroad and egalitarian racially and so on before the Civil War. There was a very strong intellectual tradition, and he has a sort of, he has that sort of refinement about him in the first place. In the second place, he is writing to his son, and he, as he says, you know, he wants to give a candid version of his better self or something to that effect. In other words, not to be too distant, but on the other hand, also to present himself in a way that the son can respect, you know.
There's a sermon that he writes in, I think it's 1918. The flu pandemic is sweeping around the world and killing many people. And the United States has entered World War I, and a lot of soldiers who are preparing to go to Europe to fight in that war are dying here of the flu. And he's trying to think about what to tell the parents who are coming to church. Can you talk a little bit about what he thinks about telling them and why he decides to never actually give that sermon?
Well, he thinks of telling them that it is God's way of saying don't enter war, you know, that if you have the option of doing it, don't do it. He lets the parents believe that he means that they're being spared the trenches and the mustard gas of the First World War. But what he means more profoundly is that God is sparing them the act of killing, which from his point of view, of course, is a greater rescue.
But he actually never gives that sermon. He burns it.
Yes.
Why does he burn it?
Well, it's a continuous problem, I think, that ministers have, that they're often speaking to people who actually agree with them. He doesn't have, among the people that come to his church through this pandemic when many, many things simply closed down, there are people who he knows are as heartbroken about all this death and all the warfare and so on as he is. So he sees no point in assuming the posture of preaching against something that he knows that everyone in the room is in grief about already.
Your minister, your main character, says, "For me, writing has always felt like praying, even when I wasn't writing prayers, as I was often enough." Is writing like praying for you?
I suppose it is. I sometimes think it's more like praying than praying is. I mean, in the sense that it, you have concrete evidence of what you have done and what you have shied away from and so on. Very interesting.
I don't think I quite get it. Tell me more about how for you the process of writing compares to prayer.
Well, I think it's a very hard thing to say, perhaps because people have different ideas and experiences related to prayer. For me, it's a kind of meditation. And I think that writing certainly is meditative in the sense that you have to feel that it answers to some standard of truth, however oblique the relationship of fiction to truth might be in the usual understanding of it.
My guest is Marilyn Robinson. Her new novel is called Gilead. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Marilyn Robinson. Her new novel, Gilead, is written in the form of a letter from a 76-year-old Congregationalist minister to his 7-year-old son. The minister believes he's dying and wants to pass on the story of his life. You know, you're writing from the point of view of a minister, and I think you get to a lot of interesting things that a minister must experience. Like you write, you're describing a scene in which he's passing a group of people who are joking around with each other, but as soon as they see the minister, they stop joking. And the minister writes, that's the strangest thing about this life, about being in the ministry. People change the subject when they see you coming. And then sometimes those very same people come into your study and tell you the most remarkable things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I get a fair amount of mail and email and so on from ministers and priests and so on. And they confirm this, that on the one hand they are rather isolated and on the other hand they are on terms of remarkable intimacy, often with people who have not treated them, you know, as people with whom they were familiar or at ease until confession or until counseling or whatever, you know.
I guess they're treated really differently when someone's alone in the room with them than in a group.
Yes, I think that's very true. And also, when they're fulfilling the role that they have of helping people to make sense of grief or crisis or anger or whatever, then, of course, they have to be privy to remarkable things.
So why do a lot of ministers write to you?
I think one of the main reasons is because ministers and priests are very used to being described in most unflattering terms in literature. And they're, I think, quite pleased in general to find that I've made a character who is likable, positive, intelligent, not a hypocrite.
Something else about your character, John Ames, the minister, he lost his young wife and their baby in childbirth, and then he was alone for decades until in his 60s he meets and marries a younger woman with whom he is deeply in love and she is deeply in love with him, and it's a beautiful marriage. They have a son, and this is the son who he's writing to, and the whole novel is the letter to his son. But anyways, during those decades when he was lonely, when he had no wife and had no child, he felt very much on the outside of life. Do you comprehend that feeling of being on the outside of life, being set apart?
Oh, I suppose I do. I frankly, I don't know what it feels like to be anyone else. So I don't know how I compare with other people in terms of my familiarity with that experience. I think that that a lot of people spend a lot of their time feeling as if life is something that sort of goes on around them because other people's lives always appear perhaps more comprehensible than their own. I mean, what you see people do seems understandable because you don't understand their doubt or their anxiety or their duplicity or whatever else might be a factor in their behavior.
Your character confesses that through the long years that he lived alone, he, quote, suffered at the spectacle of all marriages, all the households overflowing with children. And he thinks he's guilty of violating the 10th commandment, the commandment that says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, neither shalt thou desire his servant, nor his handmaiden, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is his. And he thinks that this 10th commandment is the commandment that there can be no law against. No one can punish you for coveting, I mean, for being jealous. And you can't hold yourself accountable to that, too. It's behavior that's impossible for you to enforce. Hard to change. It's hard to change those kinds of desires. I found that section really interesting. And he goes on to say that he, as a minister, has often found it difficult to rejoice with those who rejoice, as the Bible says. And he's often been much better at weeping with those who weep.
Yes.
I think that's true of so many people, that this is like the whole Schadenfreude thing, that it's sometimes hard to feel other people's joy, and it's sometimes easier to weep with those who weep. But I thought you captured it in a really beautiful way. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that the fact of his feeling jealousy in ways that he really can't control or can't rationalize himself out of, so that really the only recourse that he has is more or less to isolate himself when he can. from these spectacles of happiness that he feels excluded from. I think that that's important to him in a way, in a positive way, because he is a Calvinist. That is his tradition. And one of the things that that tradition teaches is that everyone is wrong. Everyone is flawed. And that the idea that anyone is in a position to judge someone else is a grave error. And his character, of course, is of a kind to make him scrupulous about things like this. But at the same time, I think that his compassion can arise in a great part from the suffering that he feels as someone who cannot help but envy, cannot help but desire.
You've written about John Calvin and Calvinism, and in your novel, the minister says, Calvin says somewhere that each of us is an actor on a stage and God is the audience. That metaphor has always interested me because it makes us artists of our own behavior. And the reaction of God to us might be thought of as aesthetic rather than morally judgmental. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think, why did God create the world? How does he love the world? What in the world, if you imagine him, you know, through the lens of Christ, what in the world breaks his heart? It seems to me as if it's the sort of irreducible beauty and pathos of human beings and their capacity for love and their capacity for loyalty and all the rest that is simply beautiful, even though in many forms it is in error, it is possibly destructive, and so on. I think that, for example, the gallantry of the grandfather, which finally becomes just bizarre and eccentric, is nevertheless beautiful because it is gallant, because it is self-expending, even though the obvious consequences of it are not by any means unambiguous. I think that, again, Calvin would say, if we were actually, you know, or as Hamlet said, you know, who would escape whipping, you know, if we were judged on moral terms, we wouldn't perhaps be worth attracting the notice of God in the way that theology assumes that we do, that it's the beauty of us and not the goodness of us, finally.
So is this almost like a discipline for you to try to focus on that beauty instead of judging people and to find beauty even in tragedy or ugliness?
Yes, I think that's probably fair to say.
Are you good at that? Do you succeed very often?
It's not the easiest thing in the world, you know, but that makes it interesting.
My guest is Marilyn Robinson. Her new novel is called Gilead. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Marilyn Robinson, and she has a new novel called Gilead. It's her first novel in 23 years since writing Housekeeping. How did you start writing?
That's another odd thing. I think I have always more or less done it since I've been literate. My brother, I have an older brother, 2.5 years older than I, who's a professor at the University of Virginia in art history. And when we were little kids, He was my closest friend, largely because we lived in very remote places sometimes. And he was always painting, and he was always reading, and he was always coming home from school with any information that he had, re-instructing me in whatever it was that he'd learned and so on. And he said to me one time, we both did both of these things, but he said to me one time, I'll be the painter and you be the poet. And I thought, it's a good idea. So I wrote poetry. He was utterly invaluable to me as a child, in my childhood, you know, amazing. But in any case, I did write a lot of poetry, which was good for a child and bad for anybody else. And I realized pretty soon that I would never mature as poet. And I started writing fiction, more or less, because poetry obviously was not my thing to do.
Now, your first novel, Housekeeping, was 23 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now, 23 years later, you have your second novel. You've written in between, but not a novel. So why did it take that long to write another novel?
Well, it didn't really take that long. It just was not what I wanted to do during that period of time. Mm. I don't want to make that sound more intentional than it actually was. But the things that were on my mind during that time tended to express themselves in essays. And I've written lots of essays. Sometime I'm going to put them all together. I'm sure I have at least one more book, you know. But in any case, I fiddled with fiction. I didn't find it interesting to me then, what I was doing. And then, for whatever reason, this novel came to me, and I was very happy to write it. And that's simply how things fell out. It wasn't that I intended one thing or another, or that I had a motive of a describable sort in doing one thing or the other.
Because you're so interested in religion and how religion has played a part in shaping the political and social life of America, I'd like you to share some of your observations about how religion is affecting politics today.
Well, I think there are, you know, it's a complex phenomenon. There are people who declare themselves religious, and then there are people who are religious. And these two groups of people are not necessarily the same people. There's some overlap. I think that in any Western society, religious assumptions inevitably affect politics. I think that there's a tendency now to promote too narrow an idea of what religion consists of and of what religion requires. There's a great deal of novelty, actually, in this contemporary sense of what traditional religion is. I think that it's a delicate question for this country because we have, on the one hand, a unique tradition of pluralism and, in effect, public secularism, no established church and so on. On the other hand, we do have a very pious public. These things have both been true for more than 200 years. It's a delicate thing. I don't think we could probably sit down and figure out how it has worked. But I think that the use of religion as coercive and exclusivist is something that's very well documented historically, in this country and in every other country. And it's a volatile issue. It has to be used with a great deal of respect for the religion of other people.
I imagine you've read the Bible, mm-hmm. pretty carefully as somebody who's interested in religion and the history of religion and as someone who's a writer and just as interested in language. The fundamentalists believe that the Bible is a literal truth and that it's, you know, inerring in its accuracy. As a writer who works so much with metaphor and with implied meaning, I just wonder what your reaction is to a fundamentalist reading of the Bible.
Well, I often wonder. I listen to the, you know, the self-declared religious people in the culture, and it seems to me as if they, they're obsessed very with certain passages, 2, 3, 4, to the exclusion of the rest of the literature. You know, I'm struck by how seldom the Sermon on the Mount seems to be alluded to, for example. I think that if you are a scholar of the tradition, you become very aware that the great interpreters are also aware of the great complexity of interpretation. People like Calvin and Luther, both of whom made translations of the Bible, Calvin into Latin, but Luther into German, of course. If you read the commentaries, they know that a word can mean several things, and that in many instances there's no way in the text to make a definitive translation, and that it has to be understood as something that finally the reader determines, and so on. The sola scriptura standard that is so often invoked as if it meant some sort of, you know, free form, free association, actually comes from the fact that it's a complex ancient literature that people with the best knowledge in the world struggle to translate. And therefore, one, the individual reader is highly responsible for the interpretation of many things that are crucial to it.
Well, Marilynne Robinson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Marilynne Robinson's new novel is called Gilead. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Lynn Cheney about many things, including writing children's books. Her latest is called When Washington Crossed the Delaware. Before Lynn Cheney's husband was elected vice president, she was the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.